Today I'm going to be talking about our work on rope exploit mitigation. So let me start by giving you a very quick overview on the evolution of machine code level attacks and defenses. So in the beginning, we had the code injection attacks, where an attacker was able to add some new code on a vulnerable application by usually by input, and then he was able to take advantage of vulnerability to transfer the control flow to this newly injected code. So this was later fixed by enforcing the WXRX memory policy, which basically said that parts of a process memory can either be writable if they hold data or executable if they hold code, but usually not both at the same time. So the next step from the attacker side was to, instead of injecting a new code, just reusing existing pieces of the of code from the vulnerable application, we just injected some control data. And ASLR, which stands for Address Space Layout Randomization, came as a protection for this type of code reuse attacks. And although ASLR is efficient and effective, it hasn't yet proved to be a silver bullet against code reuse attacks, mainly for two reasons. So first of all, as ASLR is based on secrecy, any information leaked attacks usually break it. And here we see an example of such an attack on a recent version of Adobe Flash Player running inside the Internet Explorer. And what's more important about this type of attacks is that they become more and more popular as ASLR is being deployed. So the second thing is that even as of today, years after ASLR was proposed, it's not yet fully adopted, mainly again for a couple of reasons, which are mostly based on decisions that operating system distributions have made, like for example, not enable ASLR or some programs, or by implementing ASLR in an opt-in way. So throughout the rest of my talk, I'm going to go over some more background information about the most popular form of code reuse attacks, which is return-oriented programming. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the current defenses. And of course, I'll move on describing our work, which is a technique called Kane Bouncer. So here, on the left side, let's assume we have the runtime stack of a vulnerable program. And let's also assume that all these values there are controlled by the attacker. In the middle, we see some small code snippets from the executable parts of the same vulnerable process. And it's important to note that these instruction sequences could either correspond to code that was legitimately generated by the compiler, or even by, they could even correspond to, let's say, overlapping or unintended instructions, which are, you know, instructions within other instructions because of the variable length of the x86 architecture. Also, let's these instruction sequences are also let's also call them like gadgets in the terminology of return-oriented programming. Finally, on the right side, we'll see actions as they appear. Let's also assume that the stack pointer is on the top of the stack of the vulnerable process, and that the return instruction is executed somewhere. That, of course, will pop the first value of the stack and transfer control there, which this is actually our first gadget. So the first gadget has a pop instruction that will load the value from the stack to the EAX register, and then its return instruction will effectively link it with the next gadget, because the location of the next gadget is on the top of the stack. So the second gadget loads again another value from the stack to the EBX register this time, and then links it with the third gadget, which actually adds the values from EAX and EBX and stores the result on EAX, and then links it back to the second gadget to load yet another value from the stack to the EBX register. And finally, we see the last gadget is executed, and it will actually store the value of EAX to the memory location pointed by EBX. So what's very important to note here is that even though the attacker did not inject any new code in the vulnerable process, he was able to perform a very specific operation, that of adding two numbers and storing the result somewhere, by just controlling the values on the stack. So of course, this has been shown, it has only been shown how this technique can be used in order to perform Turing-complete computation by just finding, let's say, a good enough gadget set. So until now, there have been quite a few defenses already proposed for retail-oriented programming. And here I'm going to categorize them based on their requirements. So on one hand, we have a few proposals that are based on compiler level techniques that require the source code of a program in order to protect it. Then we have quite a few more techniques that are can be applied directly on binary programs, but they do require to disassemble them in order to protect them. And then the goal of our work is to come up with a technique that will actually will not need to modify anything on the protected programs, while at the same time, of course, maintaining a minimal performance overhead. So our technique towards that end is called K-Bouncer. It's basically a way to detect and prevent raw code execution by monitoring the executed indirect branches. Of course, by indirect branches, I mean any form of them, like returns or indirect calls and jumps. It's the key feature of K-Bouncer, it's its transparency, which makes it directly applicable on third-party applications without requiring debug symbols or any source code. And at the same time, it's compatible with modern technologies like code signing, self-modifying code, just-in-time compilation, etc. In addition, K-Bouncer is also lightweight. Practically, it has a zero performance overhead, which can get up to 4% when we artificially stress the core components. And finally, it's also effective, as it's able to prevent many real-world ROP exploits. So the ROP detection in K-Bouncer is mainly implemented or relies on two things. The first one being the detection of illegal returns, which are basically return instructions targeting to instructions not preceded by call. And then the second one being on detecting long sequences of relatively short code fragments that are chained together with any form of indirect branch. And let me go into a little bit more details for each of them. So, of course, in legitimate code, we expect return instructions to target instructions that are right after a call one. And that's because when a call instruction is executed, the return address, the address of the next instruction will be pushed on the stack. However, when ROP code is executing, we see return instructions targeting in arbitrary locations, as gadgets can be found in arbitrary locations. And here's a small example demonstrating the two cases. So on the left side, we have the returns as we would expect them to execute under normal conditions. And then on the right side, we have the return instructions as they would execute probably execute under a return-oriented code. In our implementation, in order to check for illegal returns, we just try to make sure that their target is a valid call site by just checking the bytes before the target and making sure that any call can be disassembled there. So this, of course, is a more relaxed constraint compared to the classic call-return pairing, which is usually implemented with a shadow stack, but it also has some advantages over it. For example, it's compatible with constructs that usually break the call-return pairing, like long jumps and other things, and it also allows for a much simpler implementation because we don't have to keep any state about the call stack. Although the illegal return check would be is sufficient to detect and prevent any ROP exploit that uses a return instruction to link the gadgets in arbitrary locations, there are more advanced forms that could be used to evade this simple check. And these include a ROP payload constructed out of gadgets that end on non-return instructions, which although it's more difficult, it's still feasible. And also, it could be a case that we would construct a ROP payload out of gadgets that are call preceded, let's say, that our check would allow them to execute. So for these cases, we have a second attribute that we check, which is basically counting the number of consecutive indirect branches that point to gadget locations. And in our current implementation, we have a conservative definition for gadgets, which is any instruction sequence of up to 20 instructions that end on any indirect branch. And of course, typically in the real-world exploits, we see the number of instructions in gadgets to be only about between 1 and 5 instructions. So now that we know what we want to look for, we just need a way to do it fast. And towards that end, we used the last branch record feature of the recent Intel CPUs, which when enabled, it allows us to store the last 16 executed branches on some in a set of model-specific registers on chip. And also, it allows us to filter based on the type of branches. So for example, we could filter we could decide to only keep return instructions or indirect calls, etc. Using AWR has multiple advantages for our case, some of them include having zero performance overhead for storing the branches on the chip, being fully transparent to the application, and in fact, the application will not even be able to know whether this feature is enabled or not. And then also, it does not require any debug symbol or source code. And finally, it can be dynamically enabled or disabled for any running application in a system. So although storing the branches in the LPR has no performance overhead, of course, reading these branches and then performing the checks I just mentioned before comes with an unavoidable overhead. So on one hand, the lower the frequency we perform the checks, the lower the overall overhead. However, as ROP code can run at any given point in time, the higher the frequency of the checks, the higher the accuracy. So we see here that there is an interesting trade-off. So our solution is based on the observation that any meaningful piece of ROP code will eventually need to interact with the operating system, either to open a file or open a connection, change the permissions in memory, etc. So for these reasons, we chose to put the to make the LPR checks right before a system call is executed. And this is also shown in the figure on the bottom. So assuming that each of these rectangular shapes corresponds to a memory snapshot over time, and then each of the arrows is a branch, we see that at some point on the far right side, a branch going from the lower part of the memory, which is the user space, to the upper part, which is the kernel space, and this corresponds to a system call. So at this point, KBouncer will freeze the execution, will read all the branches from the LBR, which correspond to all these arrows going back in time, and then it will check whether any of the checks are violated. And based on the outcome, it will decide whether to allow the system to execute or to kill the application. So we implemented a prototype for KBouncer on the 64-bit of Windows 7. The only difference between the design and the prototype implementation is that we chose to perform the checks on the API level, just because it's more relevant for the Windows platform. And of course, we also designed a way to make sure that the API call will be followed by the appropriate system call. So for the evaluation part, we started by testing whether the gadget chaining length check would produce any false positives when applied to normal executing code. And for this reason, we gathered a large data set of branches from popular applications like browsers, Internet Explorer, Adobe Reader, Flash Player, and also the Microsoft Office suite. Then for all of the branches there, we iterated over all the LBR instances for two sets. All the LBR instances before a protected API, and then all the LBR instances before any function call. And by protected API, we have a set of about 50 API functions that are usually that were usually used by shell code. And what we see here is that the value, or maybe the length of the chain of gadgets, as we defined it, does not really go over 6 when we're talking about the protected APIs, and doesn't go over 10 overall. So we see that we have plenty of space to select the appropriate threshold. So as for the runtime overhead, we extracted the test cases from the Wine project. And for those of you who are not familiar with Wine, Wine is a project that tries to implement the Windows API on top of the POSIX one. And it comes with an extensive, nice test suite. So what we did was to take some tests from there and compile them against the native versions of the Windows DLLs. And we chose the tests that were calling mostly the sensitive API functions. And then we measured the performance overhead of enabling KBouncer. So on average, we saw that the performance overhead was only 1%, with 4% being the worst case we saw. As for the effectiveness of KBouncer, we tested it against quite a few real-world exploits. And what's more important was that one of these exploits was also a 0-day at the time we made our tests. So here, I have some screenshots of KBouncer, of how it looks in action. What's nice about it is that we get a small pop-up window when an attack is detected. And then there's some useful information for money for the developer. And then by the time we click OK, the whole application will be killed. Of course, unfortunately, there are some limitations in the current design, mainly because of due to the limited size of the LBR, which is currently only 16 entries. So based on the current design, it could be able for an attacker to find a long enough gadget to not be considered by our gadget chain length attribute that would either be call preceded or ending in a non-return instruction, and then repeatedly use that before making the actual call to the API function he wants. However, this long gadget should not alter any of the state that was previously created by the attacker for calling the API call. And that gets a little bit more difficult with calling conventions that require arguments to be passed with registers. So it means that in these cases, the attacker should find a long enough gadget that will not alter the registers he previously set up in an unpredictable way. So as in for future work, we are trying to see whether raising the maximum gadget length for our second check would introduce any false positives or not. And at the same time, we're trying to see whether how difficult is it or easy to find such a gadget, like a long gadget, without changing a lot of the state. At the same time, we're also exploring some ways to virtually extend the LBR size. And by virtually extend, I mean we're trying to find ways to insert more LBR checkpoints further back on the execution path and not only right before the system call. So in summary, KBouncer is a transparent, lightweight, and effective ROC code detection technique that is based on monitoring of the indirect branches for illegal returns and gadget chains. Source code will be soon available. And for more information, you can check my personal website. So that will conclude my talk, and I will be open to any questions.
All right, thank you, Vasilis. Any questions, please come up to the mic. State your name and affiliation, please.
Kanjiello from Georgia Tech. So I have a question. I'm curious whether your work can handle this simple attack. Suppose I want to use RP attack to launch Virtual Protect API. Virtual Protect. Mm-hmm. This API is also mentioned in your paper. So in order to launch such RP attack, I want to launch this RP attack twice. In the first time, I only want to prepare the parameters of Virtual Protect, but without calling any Windows API. So the detection will not be checked, right? Mm-hmm. Then Before I launch my second RP attack, I just let the program running, and it will call some normal functions. So the entries in the LPR will be overwritten by normal branches, right? Yeah. Then I launch my second RP attack just with a simple call preceded gadget to call virtual protect. So I was curious whether your defense can handle this case.
So yeah, in theory that would be an example of how you could bypass it, but it's not quite clear how easy it is to do
this. I think it's very easy. Because in the first RP attack, I just use some very common gadget.
Yes, no, I understand exactly your example. I would say, based on my experience, that it's more easy what I put on the limitations than this example. I'm not saying that it's a bulletproof technique. There are some limitations. And yes, it could be the case that it could be evaded.
Yeah, personally speaking, I think such an attack is very easy to launch. And I also have another question.
Oh, well, we'll go to the second and third questioners before we return-oriented program, right? So depending on available time.
Okay. Thanks. Hi, Eric Bodden, Fraunhofer SRT. Nice talk. I was wondering whether I understood this correctly. So if I gave you a legitimate program that uses more than, let's say, 16 indirect branches in a row, then you would definitely flag a violation, right?
No? Not if the targets are not, pointing to locations where there is a small instruction sequence with another indirect branch at the bottom.
Okay.
That's why we did the false positive evaluation using, lot of programs and different workloads and stuff, and we saw that it wasn't the case.
Okay. Now I got it. Okay. Thanks.
Name and affiliation.
Simon Chong, Georgia Tech.
There's more of you. Oh my God. Keep going.
No, you can only accommodate two of us, I guess. do you handle context switch?
So context switch is handled by the operating system.
So you don't save the LBR when context switch happens?
No, because it's actually handled by the operating system. It's part of the process context.
Are you sure about that?
At least for some parts of the LBR, yes, in Windows. But again, it's a matter of the prototype implementation. For example, it's...
Well, I did my dissertation on using LBR-like things on XP, no less, not 7. It does not save any of those because Windows does not use any of those.
Yes, in XP was a few years back, so in the even in the API, nowadays, in the context API, when you use the Windows API, you are able to get from there the last branch, but only one. So in order to do that, they do save some state. So unfortunately, now they don't save all of the branches, but they do have all the required functionality to handle the LBR as
well. Well, so here's the thing. If you don't save context switch, I think what the other fellow from my school mentioned is even easier to launch. I just force the context switch before I do anything bad.
Definitely, but that's only a limitation of the current implementation of the operating system. It's not any problem with the technique itself. So if we implement it tomorrow, that would be okay. And I'm telling you, it's partly implemented almost there now. So you
inherit the limitation of the OS?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, if the implementation was in Linux, for example, it could be easily implemented to make LBR part of the context of the process context.
And I would like to point him to a reference.
Okay.
It's a Ray paper called Function Level ROP. It's from North Carolina. It used huge, actually libc function as ROP gadgets. You'll find that interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. Name and affiliation, please.
Hi, my name is Fish, and I'm from Tsinghua University. Oh, well, I don't really have any affiliation now. For now, I graduated. And I really admire your work and your idea and have been noticing your work for a long time, actually. It's like from last year, sometime, something like that. I really have a question about, regarding your implementation. Is that I noticed that you will prompt a message box after you find the attack, right? Mm-hmm. And there are some cases that when the application is attacked by an ROP gadget, sometimes either the stack pointer or the original stack will be ruined. So when you are calling a kind of Windows API, it will just stop functioning. Have you ever come across that kind of case?
Well, when
I try to implement your KBouncer, I come into that kind of situation.
I didn't really get all the details. Can you repeat? You said that the stack is being changed.
Yeah, either the stack is completely ruined, or the stack pointer is redirected to some other spaces.
So yeah. Why would this affect the message that we see? So the data for this message, let's say, come from the kernel space.
Yeah.
So in the kernel, you read the branches.
Yeah, I mean your approach will still work. But the thing is that when you are calling other Windows API, for example, the message box or other when you are trying to do some work afterwards on the stack, because you have to prompt the user anyway, right? It will cause your the target program to crash anyway. Have you ever considered that?
Yeah, if the program was crashing, yes, the program was usually crashed. Even if you see one of the screens down there, you would see the crash dialog behind. But still, at least one other thread was still alive to be able to pop up the window and then kill the whole process. But yeah, I agree on that. Funny things may happen because of the stack being changed around. But that, again, wouldn't change the detection or the prevention.
Yeah, oh no, the detection should still work.
Maybe only the second part of trying to give some usual information back. Yep.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
All right, one final question.
Hi, Ed Schwartz from CMU. Is there any problem if a ROP payload is able to write into executable memory and actually change the executable code?
Usually executable code is read-only, so it's difficult to change it. What usually happens in the ROP exploits currently is that they first call the mprotect, let's say, to change the permissions, and then copy a second stage payload to execute.
Okay. So in order I've definitely seen binaries where there are some sections that are executable and writable, though. I mean, it's not the usual case, but if that did happen, would that be a problem?
Yes, definitely. That would be a problem. Well, in this case, we'd have a plain code injection attack, not even a ROP attack, right? Because you just put your code in the writable and executable memory part.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Well, Vasilis had a number of tough questions. Let's give him a hand.